to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible.
That was odd. That was odd. It wasn't our show. I was like, whoa, we're playing someone else's show. Oh my gosh. Well, welcome to another episode of, oh yeah, We the People Radio.
Yeah.
I remembered partway through. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape is located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they can take care of all your John Deere needs. Give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
There you are. Oh, my goodness. Well, that kind of threw me for a loop there. All of a sudden, I'm like, wait, what is that sound? That's not right. Oh, my goodness. Well, we are doing a part two program today. So last week we spoke with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, and we realized, well, we had a whole bunch of questions that we, you know, like things we wanted to know from her, and we realized we checked off, like, none of them. And we didn't talk about her book. There was just tons of stuff we didn't do. So we asked her if she would offer up another Sunday afternoon and hang out with us. And she graciously agreed. Gotta love her. It's October the 8th, 2023. So obviously the first show is October 1st. And I have that linked on the page today at wethepeopleradio.us. So let's tell you a little bit about Dr. Curry. She's the president and co-founder of the Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and predictions and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Following an influential career in academic research and administration, she founded CFAN to translate cutting-edge weather and climate research into forecast products and services that support the management of weather and climate risk for public and private sector decision makers. Curry is a leading global thinker on climate change. She is frequently called upon to give U.S. congressional testimony and serve as an expert witness on matters related to weather and climate. Her influential blog, Climate Etc., addresses leading-edge and controversial topics about climate change and the science-policy interface. And that is really where the rubber meets the road, is where the science and the climate chit-chat goes. There's really quite a gap there. Her new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response and How We Can Respond, is really quite good. I've only gotten into it a little bit, but I would really encourage you to go take a look at that. So it's Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response is the name of the book. And her name is Judith Curry, C-U-R-R-Y. Her website is judithcurry.com. Super easy. Easy to remember. And we just hear so much about climate change. We are just buried in this stuff, and we pay so much money to, yeah, you know, supposedly change the weather in the future, which changes the climate on the earth and the temperature of the ocean and all these things. And I think most people go, wait a minute, can we even do that? But they can't fight back because they have no venue to do it. And meanwhile, the money is being siphoned out and delivered to the people who, I don't know, are either the true believers or the true deceivers, I guess, maybe a little of both, on this topic. So we thought it was really important to go a little farther with Dr. Curry. So good afternoon to you.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. Sorry, I had to do the long lead-in just because I think it's really important that people realize that this isn't just your opinion. That you, like, you know, like the rest of us, we look out the window and we realize, like, we've seen winter, spring, summer, fall. We've seen it snow more, snow less, rain more, rain less. And if you're, you know, as you get older, you realize, well, tornadoes are, I mean, we've had tornadoes, we've had hurricanes, we've had, like, all these different things, and you start wondering, really? Like, in the 70s, they told us we were all going to die because we were going to freeze to death, and then it was global warming, and now it's climate change, and you start feeling like you're getting played.
Yeah, and we're still having tornadoes and hurricanes, and, you know.
So, I mean, We have opinions. You actually have facts. So we appreciate you bringing those and sharing them with us.
Well, yeah. I mean, over the many decades that I've been in this field, I've done a lot of research and I've done a lot of analysis. And many of the most consequential issues are discussed in my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Yeah. And so do you want to start there so we don't get derailed, on all the – we can rabbit trail back to the things we spoke about before, but your book does a great job, and I would really like to promote it more because a lot of – I'm sure there's a segment of the population out there that's going, I don't know if I want to read a book about climate change. So maybe we could make this like, yes, you do want to read it, and this is why. How about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a, for over a decade, it's been at the top of the international agenda, climate change. And depending on which state you live in, well, if you're in California, it's also at the top of your state agenda.
And our checkbooks.
Yeah. And the concern that people have is what, they just see, day-to-day, year-to-year weather variability. They're not really, seeing anything that's particularly unusual. But what they do see is the consequences of the policies that are being put in place. I mean, with California being a notable, example in the U.S., I mean, your electricity prices and gasoline prices are hugely high. There's occasional intermittent outages. It's becoming less reliable.
Yeah, that they plan. They actually, everyone has to buy an electric car. Oh, wait, don't charge your electric car. We're not going to have power for the next. And they'll shut it off for periods of time.
Right. And this is costing people money, having to buy, induction stoves and electric vehicles and encouraged to put solar panels on their houses and on it goes. And it's really expensive. Some of these technologies are nice, but, being effectively forced to do it, isn't very good for many people who, don't have the money to do this and have other priorities.
Well, and even the solar. Like solar on your house doesn't work when there's no electricity and the sun goes down unless you have battery backup.
Exactly. You have to have battery backup. I have solar on my house and two Tesla Powerwalls. I wasn't going to do solar until I had battery backup for that reason. I was interested in doing this for energy security, not to, save a few poultry molecules of CO2 from being emitted into the atmosphere.
How dare you?
Atta girl.
So,
that's how we love
and
you.
The issue is I've gone electric in a lot of ways. We have an electric heat pump, an induction stove, and an electric vehicle. And all those use up a lot of electricity. Like in 2020, before I bought all these electric appliances, the solar panels were really covering my electricity use, and now they're covering less than half of my electricity use.
Oh, wow.
So people don't realize if everybody goes electric, we're going to have to more than double, our electricity output. And, wind and solar are just not going to cut it.
No. And would double even do it?
Well, not okay. People don't appreciate that our demand for electricity is just growing, growing, growing. And it's not just, these appliances, but all the, big data centers and artificial intelligence and blockchain use up a crazy amount of electricity. And all these have societal advantages, which I expect will grow in the coming decades. So, I think people are underestimating how much electricity we're going to need in the future. Last Christmas, there was a huge cold event in the eastern U.S., and particularly in Tennessee, and they totally underestimated the demand because they weren't aware they weren't factoring in that so many people had installed heat pumps, you know, for heating and air conditioning. And when it got really cold, it was like just a huge drain on the electricity need, and that wasn't factored into their demand. And the only thing that really saved them was nuclear power generated in Illinois that was transmitted to Tennessee. So people, you know, electric utilities just keep getting surprised by how much.
Well, look what happened in Texas when they had a freeze event, what, last year or year before, and all windmills froze.
It was in February. It was really cold,
And they were in trouble.
And one of the things that's not really appreciated, you know, when you have one of these challenging situations when it's like it's really cold, I mean, that's challenging enough as it is, but when a big part of your electricity generation is from wind and solar, then that's another big piece of uncertainty, and it just makes the grid so much harder to operate. Okay, when you have, you know, a large penetration of renewables like you do in Texas, and they came really close to a total, you know, grid blackout, which would have taken them more than a week to restore electricity, but they managed to, you know, adjust, you know, and get back their frequency control just in time. The other thing about Texas is there was maybe it was last year, a big summer heat event, and they were worried about electricity demand. And then the blockchain people said, oh, well, we'll cut back during this period. We'll cut back our electricity usage by whatever percent. I go, wait a minute. How much electricity is blockchain using in Texas? It must be a huge amount. And, you know, we're not appreciating these non sort of traditional uses of electricity when we're factoring into the supply and demand of electricity. So we're setting ourselves up for some real vulnerabilities when we get surprises.
I bet if you went out there with a handful of $100 bills and asked people to give you their top 10 uses of electricity, blockchain wouldn't even be on the list ever. You'd go back with all your money. Like, no one thinks of that. I don't believe anybody thinks of that.
No. So I followed my household electricity usage, you know, fairly closely. But you know, it's surprising what, you know, what uses a lot of electricity, and it's not always what you would think. Managing your household use of electricity, you know, is a decision that everybody, you know, makes, and they decide what they want to do. But I have to say that going all electric is really, really expensive. So, you know, combined with the money I shelled out for electric appliances and solar panels and the Tesla Powerwall, I spent a lot of money. But, well, you know, I like the new technologies, and since I'm in this field, I need to understand them and, you know, be knowledgeable about them. So that was a big motivation for my doing this, but it's really, really expensive.
Yeah, so to apply that to everybody, you look at people who live in apartments, you look at all sorts of, I mean, people who rent, you know, you go rent a townhouse or whatever. Can you imagine if they had to outfit it with all this stuff? What, I mean, it'd just be cost prohibitive. People wouldn't, you know, yes, the landlord would be the one who had to put it all in, but they're going to have to recoup the cost somehow. I don't think, and you know, the other thing too, we learned a long time ago, you know, I think you learn really, really early on in life. Somebody tells you don't put all your eggs in one basket. And even as a kid, like, you figure out, okay, I mean, you figure that out at Halloween. Figure that out at Halloween. You never carry all your candy. Because there's always some kid who's going to come and grab it all. So you make periodic trips back to the house to dump out the pillowcase so that you don't have all the candy in one bag. And so, you know, here we are all electric when we have all these other means of powering things. You know, you have natural gas. See, it's great. Like, if the power goes out and you have your stove or, you know, your heating is natural gas, you're only partly screwed. You know, you can't flip your lights on, but you can still cook stuff and you're not freezing cold. I don't know. I mean, having that variety gives us a lot, and as we innovate in one sector or another, you know, we can advance here and maybe take a little bit away from over here. But just this mandated, we were driving yesterday, drove to Sacramento and back, and Bill's like, man, I think having a Tesla car would be so stressful. You'd spend your whole time thinking about how many more miles you had to go and where your next charging station was.
And how long you got to wait to get it charged and what time you have to be there. And, I mean, there's so much, seems like to be a lot of planning involved driving one of those. Because it's not like driving by a gas station every corner, you know.
We drove 300 miles there, 300 back. And most of it is through really open country where we saw zero charging stations on our journey.
Well, California has more charging stations. Okay, I'm in Nevada. And when I drive, say, from Nevada to Colorado, I'm going through Utah and Wyoming, there are, not only are there not that many gas stations, but there are really no charging stations.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a lot of charging stations in California compared to everywhere else in the country.
I bet, just not in far northern California. Up here, you know.
Yeah, right.
you've got a lot of open ground. I guess we have to take a break. I wasn't really paying attention, but we are tardy. Take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I've done the math, calibrated the imperfections. I got my slide rule from school. You add it up, and it don't add up. Shed some light on it too. And I'm just inches close to the finish. Cross it and bid you adieu. I calculated every combination, every misdirection, every subtle deception. Kickstart my thinking, I was lost in space, staring at a spot on the moon. Negotiating the anticipation of reentering the atmosphere too soon.
People think I'm crazy, cause I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now. But I don't think so, cause it's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there.
Well, we'll let Randy Newman just explain that to you. You might want to look the song up. It's an old one, but it's a good one.
You know, we had earlier mentioned the Teslas and electric vehicles. I read an article last week. There is in France, they committed a lot of money, a lot of public funds to electric vehicles and public transportation. And they had a picture of a field that had hundreds and hundreds of these electric vehicles parked. And the problem was, they introduced all these vehicles, and everybody was driving them, and it was working out real good. Well, then the batteries started wearing out, and they found out that replacing the batteries was going to cost more than the vehicles were worth. So they started parking them. And now they have hundreds of these vehicles these boneyards, unable to run them, and they are now leaking. These batteries are leaking out onto the ground, and now they've got an environmental problem with this stuff going back into the soil. So I don't know. Did you hear anything, or have you read anything about that, Dr. Cray?
I haven't. Not in France. I know that in China they have tons of abandoned electric vehicles. So nobody's really looked at the life cycle.
Yeah, and what do you do with the batteries?
Yeah. Well, presumably the battery technologies will improve, but I'm not 100% sure that electric vehicles are the way, you know, we're going to go 100% in the future. You know, if you look ahead to 2100, a really long time away, I mean, I don't see us burning oil and gas for fuel. I mean, we may use it for other things, but I don't think we're burning it for fuel. We'll probably be mostly nuclear, and in the U.S. West, I think geothermal is a good solution. Wind farms, no. But you can create synthetic fuels, liquid fuels. So, you know, I see that. I think there's still going to be a need for liquid fuels. I mean, for aviation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly not going to be batteries. It's probably not going to be nuclear powered. But I think there's a role for synthetic liquid fuels. And it may be a better solution for, like, vehicles, cars. You know, I don't know how it's going to play out. So I think sort of putting all our eggs in this electric vehicle basket isn't terribly good. I'm sure the batteries are going to improve in the coming decades, you know, and be less toxic, not as heavy. You know, we'll see what one can hope. But right now, the batteries are extremely heavy, lots of toxic stuff in them. And the mining to actually get all those minerals is, you know, people worry about, lithium is so valuable, you know, and only a few countries are mining lithium. Well, lithium's everywhere, and only a few countries mine it because you basically need tons of slave labor, and it really messes up the environment. So you only have, you know, places like Africa and China and stuff like that who are prepared to do lithium mining just because it's so toxic. So the thing about evaluating all these technologies is that people look at how much CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and that's the main criterion. Well, it shouldn't be. You know, it should be a broader, you know, environmental issues. It should be cost, safety, reliability, the life cycle, environmental impact. You know, all these things should be evaluated rather than just, the CO2 emissions. But actually, to build an electric car, do all the mining and the construction and the steel and everything, that uses a lot of fossil fuels. And I forget how many miles you have to drive the electric vehicle to become, you know, carbon neutral. And even that depends on the source of your electricity.
I mean, that's true.
If when you plug in your car at night and the electricity is being produced by coal, I mean, you know, you're better off.
Well, like they had diesel generators behind all those Tesla chargers in California at that one big charging station,
which is just hilarious.
Right. Yeah, it's like, go across the street, and then you'll see the giant diesel generator that's powering your Tesla charging station.
Well, we're just so far from eliminating petroleum. I mean, it's petroleum is used in the manufacturing of pretty much everything, not just fuel, but the cost, if they eliminated the cost of replacing a lot of these products with non-petroleum based technology, we're not there.
We're not close to there. I mean, even just steel and cement. You know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean that uses fossil fuels and fertilizer, you know, and all these things. 50 years from now, we'll probably have better ways of doing it. But we sure as heck don't have better ways
right now.
Well, it's kind of funny. There are these things we get hooked on. Like, I remember way back, gosh, it must have been like in the 80s when I was working for Girl Scouting, and the health people got hysterical about palm oil. Oh, palm oils. You can't eat palm oils. Well, all the Girl Scout cookies that have chocolate on them, as do all the other things that have chocolate on them, are held together with palm oil. That's why it doesn't just run all over the place. Palm oil is what keeps the chocolate on the cookies. And otherwise, you just get a box with a bunch of brown, you know, schwitz in the bottom and, you know, a bunch of cookies that look dirty. It's like, yeah, you'd be pure as anything, but you'd be licking the packaging. So they wanted him to get rid of this palm oil, and they couldn't. They never could. It's so funny. I still look at packaging. Yep, palm oil, still on there. It's been keeping the chocolate on cookies since time began. And they never found a better alternative that worked. So sometimes, like the things that we want, even though that's not going to cut, well, I don't know, maybe that is the hub of climate change. It's palm oil. It's cookies. That's it. I've got to ban cookies. That's what we would do, actually, if we were going to be, you know, if we were going to think of this correctly, we would just ban all the cookies. It just seems crazy to me that we get hooked on these things, and then any idiotic answer, like, that's got to be the solution. We must get everyone to accept that. And it seems like that's what the climate, like your book starts out with, what is climate change? It's like, yeah, that's actually a pretty decent question because we're bludgeoned with it all the time. But what do they think it is? Like, what's the actual, it seems it's everything now. Everything is climate change. But what really is it?
Okay. Well, back in the day, 1970s, 1980s, when I was in graduate school, climate change was caused by many different things, geologic processes, solar variability, changes in the Earth's orbit, volcanic eruptions, you know, all sorts of processes in the oceans. And sure, humans can have an influence on the climate through land use, and through emissions, both of like greenhouse gases and also particulates, you know, like the hazy kind of stuff, pollution kind of things. So there's, you know, it's a complex mishmash of all these different processes. However, the UN has defined climate change to be only associated with human-caused emissions. Everything else is called climate variability. Now, when's the last time you heard anybody talk about climate variability?
Mostly
like
never.
They talk about climate change, and there's an implicit assumption that climate only changes, you know, from emitting fossil fuels. And I remember giving a talk. This was, I think, at a meeting of, like, related to, you know, electric utilities, owners and operators and things like that. We're talking about sea level rise. And one person says, wow, I didn't realize that sea level rise started, you know, has happened all through geologic history. I thought sea level rise only started once we were emitting fossil fuels. You know, and that's how the UN was trying to mislead you. It worked.
Exactly.
You know, natural climate variability has sort of been defined out of existence by the UN. And see, you know, I'm going to say, you know, like almost 20 years ago, the propagandists, you know, who are trying to promote action on climate change figured out that extreme weather events are going to alarm people. The slow creep of sea level rise, that's not going to alarm anyone. And Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was really a turning point because, I mean, that was, you know, just the worst disaster that had struck the U.S. in a long time. And there were some people who were saying that warming sea surface temperatures could make hurricanes more intense. So all of a sudden, people saw global warming are making hurricanes more intense, and all of a sudden people cared about global warming, so they didn't want any more Katrinas. So once you start blaming every severe weather event on global warming, or every failed crop, anything that happens in society, oh, it's global warming, and then that allows people to just shrug their shoulders and throw up their hands and
exactly.
say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's global warming. And that's really dangerous because it gives us an out, so we don't have to really look at the causes of our societal vulnerability. You know, poor land use management, poor governance, you know, crumbling infrastructure, whatever. I mean, it gives us an out from confronting our real problems. Oh, it's just climate change. And, you know, in order to fix it, we have to stop using fossil fuels. And what these people don't realize is that even if we were, if we did manage to get to net zero by 2050, which is, as far as I can tell, an impossibility, we wouldn't notice any change in the weather or climate. We might start to notice something in the 22nd century. I mean, we've always had extreme weather events. We have them now. We'll have them in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, none of that's going to go away. And even with sea level rise, I mean, that doesn't turn on a dime. I mean, it takes centuries to sort of, there's so much inertia in the oceans and the ice sheets. Like, none of that's going to turn on a dime. So.
Yeah, the idea that we can control the temperature of the entire ocean. It's like,
well, the idea.
Okay.
How about?
That's just kooky.
You know, the climate is going to be unlivable in, what was it, 12 years?
Well, I think that's this year, isn't it?
Yeah, we're getting awful close to that.
Well, you know, the crazy thing, you know, like the one impact of a warmer climate is more frequent heat waves, or at least more intense, depending on how you're going to define them. But in terms of overall mortality, almost an order of magnitude more people die from cold extremes than they do heat extremes.
Exactly.
And this has been shown all over the world in many, many studies, so it's not just the U.S. or whatever. I mean, extreme cold events are more lethal than heat events. So if we're increasing our heat events, but decreasing the cold events, that's overall going to reduce mortality from temperature extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is a good thing.
but that isn't how it is portrayed.
It's not.
All this is coming for you like a giant monster, and then they can come up with all these crazy things that you have to do in order to mitigate for the thing that isn't even a thing, but nobody asks, is it a thing? Right? They get all tangled up in the mitigation, and nobody says, should we mitigate?
Yeah, it's been like that from the very beginning. I mean, you have to go, you know, in 1992, we had the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change put forward a treaty to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change through eliminating fossil fuel emissions. I mean, this was in 1992, before there was even any evidence of warming or that it was dangerous. We understood nothing. But they had the policy objective in place. I mean, this, you know, was an environmentalist agenda, an anti-capitalist agenda. You know, we hate the oil companies agenda. It was a non-governmental world control agenda. And a population control agenda.
I mean, I think we would be remiss to leave that out.
Sure. So this was, you know, the agenda. And so the focus was on dangerous human-caused climate change. And so we're all chasing that down. I mean, nobody's talking about natural climate variability. And nobody's talking about
benefits. We can all see out the window.
Right. Exactly. And nobody's talking about the benefits of a warmer climate. If you're living in Canada or Russia or northern China, I mean, a warmer climate.
Yeah,
probably.
They pray for that.
They'd be super excited about that, actually. Well, it's kind of funny, I guess, in my, you know, if I was going to condense it down and like in my mind and I sort of look at it in fast forward or like the 30,000 foot view, I think, let's see. They were hysterical. We were all going to die from eating palm oil. So we had to, you know, bludgeon the Girl Scouts to change their cookie recipe. But the thing that's funny is they're still eating it. It's 2023. Girl Scouts are still selling cookies and nobody's dead yet. So, and they gave up. They're not talking about it anymore. And I thought, you know what? Maybe the name of the game is outlast them. Eat your Wheaties and live longer. You can watch them just fade away and come up with some other nonsense, because there's more nonsense coming, I'm sure. There just seems to be like the Department of Nonsense that churns this stuff out secretly. And there's a group buying it every minute. We got to take a really quick break, though. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. We love her. Our time always goes too fast with her because we talk too much. Sorry. We'll be right back.
Who's to say I can't do everything? Well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. Oh, what I would do to have the kind of strength it takes to stand before a giant. With just a sling and a stone, surrounded by the sound of a thousand warriors, shaking in their armor, wishing they'd have had the strength to stand. But the giant's calling out my name and he laughs at me, reminding me of all the times I tried before and failed. The giant keeps on telling me time and time again, boy, you'll never win. You'll never win. But the voice of truth tells me a different story. The voice of truth says do not be afraid. And the voice of truth says this is for my glory. Out of all the voices calling, choose to listen and believe the voice of truth. The stone was just the right
thing. Yeah, I think that's, I think Casting Crowns has it right. The voice of truth is sometimes hard to find, sometimes hard to discern, but once you hear it, you recognize it. Like the things that you tell us, Dr. Curry, about all of this climate change and all the policy goals and the stuff, it resonates because you realize that actually makes sense. You hear the other stuff and you go, what? You can't help it. So tell us this, like I'm actually just looking at the index in your book, and I understand why you did it the way you did, because it's for us regular people. So it starts out with what is climate change, but then you move into what do we know with confidence? So what do we know that's actually true? And when we hear deviations from that, we should know they're kind of coloring outside the lines.
Okay. Well, global temperature has been increasing since about 1860. Nobody questions that. We disagree about the magnitude, and the data is never perfect, but we know which direction it's been going. We know that humans emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Nobody questions that. Carbon dioxide has an infrared emission spectra, which means that that's sort of like a fancy couple of words. It helps keep the Earth's heat, in the Earth's system rather than just radiating out to space. Nobody disagrees on those three things. But the most consequential issues, there's substantial disagreement on. I mean, how much warming is caused by this additional CO2, and is it larger than natural climate variability? There's disagreement on that. How is the climate of the 21st century going to play out? There's a huge amount of uncertainty on that one. Warming dangerous? Well, this is the weakest part of the argument. There's a lot of disagreement as to whether overall warming of the planet is dangerous. And finally, there's huge disagreement about whether rapidly reducing our emissions of CO2 is going to make humans better off now and in the future. So the most consequential issues, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of disagreement.
Which makes it difficult for the people raising questions, because the narrative has always been about, I forget, 95% of the
scientists.
Is it 97% of all the scientists agree? And it's like, okay, you can't get 90% of anything to agree on anything. That's just silly.
Well, they agree on those first three points about the warming atmosphere and CO2 emissions and the infrared emission spectra. I mean, everybody agrees on that. But they've tried to parlay this into, well, through consensus entrepreneurship, to extending this consensus on these basic facts to go way beyond.
Right. That 97% of them agree we need to, you know, destroy modern civilization in order to save the planet.
Okay. Well, this is the scary part.
Scarier than that?
Well,
just kidding.
You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, a lot of activists said, oh, wow, I'm really interested in this issue. And they went and got their PhD, and now they're predominant in the university. There was a recent survey of U.S. university climate researchers, and something like 70% of them favored degrowth, not just green growth, but actual degrowth. You know, they want, you know, fewer people. They want us to consume less. They want us to lose fossil fuels. And that's a scary high number. I mean, like, what are the, you know, there's really two fundamentally different worldviews. Well, there's many permutations, but there's one that, you know, views humans as a blight on the planet. And, you know, just wishes we weren't here. And then there's another one who, on the other side, you take humans for granted, you know, at the top of the heap, you know, and how can we thrive as humans, you know, on this earth? And we do understand that we can't totally trash the earth if we're going to live here comfortably, but it's really more of a human-centric, you know, view on the world and the climate. So, I mean, that's just two fundamentally different worldviews, and I don't know what personality traits or cultural factors or educational issues contribute to why you end up with one or the other worldviews, but that's really what's at the heart of the conflict over this issue. People who just want humans and modern society to go away. And the others who want humans to thrive and flourish, and the more the better.
Well, but the funny part is that first group, like, the thing that you figure out right away is they want other humans to go away and other people's creature comforts to go away and other, like, not their own. Like, those are the people who are flying in private jets to the climate conference.
Exactly, exactly. So it's massive hypocrisy. So I don't know how they deal with that cognitive dissonance in their own heads.
I think it's
really
called lying.
Yeah.
We also learned that when we were children. I think our parents busted us on that one. It involves soap in your mouth, I believe. Yeah. You know.
Well, I think another thing they don't really consider, or maybe they do, is a lot of this climate change is really kind of cherry-picked. I mean, the Earth is a huge ecosystem, and to go around and pick certain regions that have their climate is changing doesn't mean the entire system is in danger. And I think that's the way they're treating it, is, you know, the Earth is going to be unlivable. Well, certain areas, I mean, look at some of the deserts on our planet that didn't used to be deserts. You know, I mean, it's an ebb and flow kind of a thing. But to think that human beings can change that, can stop that from happening, it's that we can't. We can't stop that. I mean, things are going
to
change.
Have you ever tried to eradicate weeds in your yard? I mean, even just the weeds in your yard, we can't control that. And I'm like, when you can have a weed-free lawn, give me a call and we'll put you in charge of the world. But until then, you're just a regular person like the rest of us.
Well, you know, this goes back to the whole UN agenda. You know, they define this climate change to be irreducibly global, and therefore the solution had to be global, you know, and this leads
right.
us to the that we're currently in. But, you know, climate is local. You know, they're in the U.S., there's like in the southeast U.S., they haven't really been warming at all, you know, so...
Well,
know,
that's what I mean. Yeah,
time.
it's very regional. I mean, it just depends on where
sure.
you look.
And then certainly in the western U.S., well, most of the U.S., the 1930s were the period with the worst weather, the worst heat waves, the worst droughts, forest fires, even the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes. So, you know, there's a lot of regionality to climate and extreme weather. So, you know, and then they cherry pick each extreme event, you know, wherever it happens over the world. Oh, it's global warming. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's the large scale ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that conspire to give us extreme weather events. You know, it's
how about
not
the
CO2.
Sun? And how about the sun? I mean, the sun's a major driver of all of this.
Oh, sure. You know, the sun. Well, one of the issues is that the sun has been marginalized in all this, and because the focus is dangerous, human-caused climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun has been rather marginalized. I mean, we had a grand solar maximum in the late 20th century, and the effect of that on warming the climate is dismissed, all but dismissed. Okay, and, you know, it just makes no sense. So we haven't adequately investigated the solar influences on the recent climate. And there's a lot of indirect solar effects that aren't sufficiently well understood. So I think there's plenty that we don't know about the sun influences on the climate. But even what we do know, well, there is disagreement, but, I mean, it's almost certainly bigger than what the UN climate assessments are telling us.
Oh, yeah, because it was, it's been quite a few years ago, but we had Dr. Willie Soon on.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he's the sun guy. And
yeah.
just the things that he listed, I was like, oh, for heaven's sakes. You never hear any of those things. You never hear anything about the sun
it's
in this debate.
Because it goes against the...
Well, it blows the orthodoxy out of the
exactly.
water. And the great part of it... What a bonus. Nobody knows anything about the sun. So if you don't talk about it, nobody goes, hey, what about the sun? Like, right? It's just the thing we don't talk about.
Yeah, I mean, and we're fooling ourselves. You know, there could be real surprises in store.
That we would be totally unprepared for, because unlike the companies that you advise, on weather and prediction and all those things, you're helping them prepare for the future. The bad part is we as a global society, doesn't matter really what facet of it you look at, they're not making those plans. I mean, we're not sober decision makers there.
Right. I mean, we could really be surprised. And this is what part two of my book goes into, you know, how might we be surprised by how climate plays out in the 20th century. The sun is one issue, but volcanic eruptions, for the last 150 years, the volcanoes have really been very quiet. I mean, we've had a few notable ones, but overall they've been very quiet. But in the first half of the 1800s, not all that long ago, we had three massively explosive eruptions, including Tambora. It was a year without a summer. I mean, and global temperatures drop like a degree Fahrenheit for a couple of decades because of these volcanic eruptions. And all of the, and it, you know, reflected all of the sulfate that goes into the atmosphere, reflected a lot of sun, which was really bad for crops. you know, which led to, you know, famines and whatever. And, you know, people just, you know, assume, well, even the UN climate assessment assumes that volcanoes will be pretty much like they
volcanoes
were for
are
the
no
last
big thing.
100 years.
Let's talk about that when we come back on the backside of the news. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.